Freud doubted that an Israelite would grow up a member of the elite and then decide to identify with the enslaved, the poor, and downtrodden. But that, of course, is exactly what happened to Freud's neighbor, who lived several minutes away. Herzl grew up as part of European society and then decided to devote his life to his persecuted brethren. Welcome to Parsha and Politics, Parshat Shemot. Moses, Freud, and Herzl in Vienna. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Parsha and Politics, How Torah Changed the World, is generously sponsored by Ivan Kaufman. Rabbi Soloveitchik's podcasts and essays on the Book of Exodus are generously sponsored by Karen and Alec Taylor. This week's episode is generously sponsored by Richard Sperry.
In Vienna, at 19 Bergenstrasse, sits the Freud Museum, the former home of Sigmund Freud. A bit down the street, at 6 Bergenstrasse, sits the house where Theodor Herzl once lived. According to Google Maps, it is a 2-minute stroll from one domicile to the other. The two most famous Jews in the history of Vienna were neighbors, lived right next to each other, and presumably passed each other often in the street. And yet, as far as we know, they did not meet in person. To ponder these two Viennese neighbors is to realize the profound similarities between them, as well as their differences. Both, in their youth, represented the trend of Jewish abandonment of tradition and ritual in Western Europe. Both attended the University of Vienna and launched themselves upon successful careers. And both publicized, at around the same time, the unique ideas that defined their lives, and on which their fame would be founded. And in very different ways, the respective reaction of each to his own Jewishness dominated the last years of the lives of each of these men. Herzl, of course, devoted the end of his short life to the Zionist cause. Meanwhile, Freud, having fled from Vienna in the wake of the Anschluss, would publish in London before he died the shocking work Moses and Monotheism, in which he would insist that much of what Judaism claimed about its most famous figure was a lie. This contrast between Herzl and Freud in Vienna is worth rediscovering today as we begin the second book of the Tanakh, when the story of Moses begins. Reading the text through the lens of the Viennese Jewish experience and the biographies of Herzl and Freud will reveal deeply relevant teachings about Jewish identity, anti-Semitism, and the remarkable story of our people. In English, we refer to the second book of the Bible by the political term Exodus, but in Jewish parlance it is known as Shemot, names, playing on the first verse. Ve'ele Shemot b'nei Yisrael haba'im Mitzrayma, and these are the names of the children of Israel that were coming to Egypt. It is seemingly strange that the Bible, which already described the coming to Egypt of Jacob's family in Genesis, would describe it immediately again, and in the present tense. But for Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, that is precisely the point. Even after the children of Israel sojourned for centuries in Egypt, they were still seen by Egyptians as outsiders, recent arrivals. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, quote, "Even though B'nai Yisrael came many years earlier, Egypt still viewed them as strangers. This belief in the otherness of the Jew repeats itself through history." End quote. The perceived otherness of Israel in Exodus inspires a new pharaoh, who knew not Joseph, to enslave Israel and also to engage in the infanticide of Israelite babies. Thus does the first major persecution in our history begin. With this in mind, we turn to the Western Europe of the late 19th century. There, Jewish success in society was made manifest, but the Jews were seen as others. As the historian Robert Wistrick tells us, the year 1848 heralded an era of emancipation for the Jews of the city. They sought, much as Jews did in America, to advance themselves as much as possible through education. The response to this enormous influx of Jews into the academic and professional life of Vienna, Wistrick writes, was the rise of Jew hate. Quote, "Though Vienna had emerged as the largest Jewish city in the Austrian half of the empire and as a dynamic creative center of Jewish life, the success story had already been somewhat tarnished by the strength of political anti-Semitism in the city since the 1880s. The mass exodus to Vienna had opened up a new world of secular modernity and unprecedented opportunities to thousands of Jews, but in its wake it also brought new problems of identity and the ominous rise of a raucous mass politics, one of whose primary vehicles was Judeophobia." End quote. It was in just such a Vienna that both Freud and Herzl were raised, experiencing the best of Austrian culture, but ultimately making very different choices about their respective relationship with the Jewish people. We keep this in mind as we now study the story of Moses, which is also a tale of assimilation and discovered identity. The details are well known. A Hebrew family of the tribe of Levi have a son. Seeking to save him from the pharaonic decree, the mother places her child in a basket in the Nile. There he is saved by a daughter of Pharaoh, who bestows a striking name upon the baby. And she named him Moshe, for she said, I have drawn him, Mishitihu, out of the water. The simple understanding is that the appellation is a Hebrew pun, Moshe, for Mishitihu, I have drawn him. But countless commentators find this profoundly puzzling. Why would an Egyptian princess ascribe to her son a name bearing a Hebrew play on words? It is therefore more likely, as Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin argues, that the name was not intended by its bestower as a pun. Moses, in Egyptian, is essentially the word for son, S-O-N. For Rabbi Berlin, Pharaoh's daughter is exclaiming, I have drawn him from the water, I have saved his life, therefore he is now my son. Moses, in other words, is an Egyptian name. This is even more striking when we consider the fact that presumably Moses' Israelite parents bestowed a Hebrew name upon their child at his birth. Indeed, the Midrash contains all sorts of suggestions as to that appellation, but never, not once, are those names used in the Torah. What this means is that Moses presumably knew that he was a Hebrew, but even his very name bespoke his assimilation into Egyptian society. Yet Moses knows that his brethren suffer, and this draws him to them. Exodus again. And he went out to his brothers and saw their labors, and he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew from among his brothers. For Ibn Ezra, the emphasis on brotherhood is meant to mark the transformation of Moses. When he first set out to study the slaves, Ibn Ezra argues, he may have seen the Egyptian taskmasters as his brothers. But then, in the suffering of Israel, he finds his own flesh and blood. In other words, Moses feels forced to choose between seeing himself as an Egyptian or a Hebrew. It is the suffering of his brethren that summons within Moses a sudden embrace of his own Israelite identity. Winston Churchill, in his incredible 1931 essay on Moses, describes Moses' beholding the enslavement of his fellow Hebrews as follows. Churchill writes, quote, he sees them the drudge of Egypt consuming their strong life and seed in the upholding of its grandeur, and even grudge the pittance which they earn. He sees them treated as a helot class. They, the free children of the wilderness, who came as honored guests and had worked every hour of their passage. Upon these general impressions, he sees an Egyptian beating an Israelite. No doubt, a common spectacle, an episode coming to be accepted as part of the daily social routine. But he has no doubts. He knows which side he is on. And Churchill concludes, the call of blood surges in him. He slays the Egyptian amid the loud and continuing applause of the insurgents of the ages. So Churchill writes, and his point is that in this one act, to speak anachronistically, Moses becomes a Jew. It is in feeling the suffering of his brethren that Moses is inspired to find his own true identity. It is striking, therefore, to ponder the way in which Herzl embraced his own Jewishness. The signal inspiration for Herzl's transformation seems to have been the political rise of Vienna's mayor Karl Luger, who placed anti-Semitic rhetoric at the very center of his platform. Luger, who transformed Vienna into a modern city, was the role model of a man who studied in Vienna during Luger's administration, Adolf Hitler, who would give Luger a special mention in his book Mein Kampf. The rise of Luger struck Herzl profoundly. In his diary, he describes being present at an election in Vienna when Luger appeared. Herzl wrote, municipal elections in Vienna took place the day before Rosh Hashanah Eve. The anti-Semites won all the mandates. The mood among the Jews is desperate. The propaganda against them has whipped up a lot of hatred among the Christians. And Herzl further writes, one sees the look of hatred everywhere, even without the paranoid fear that makes one go around seeking eye contact. On election day, I was in Leopoldstadt, outside the polling place, to take a closer look at all the hate and anger. Toward evening, I went to the Landstrasse district. In front of the polling place, a silent, tense crowd. Suddenly, Dr. Luger stepped out onto the square. Wild cheers, women waving white kerchiefs from the windows. The police held the crowd back. Next to me, someone said, with tender warmth but in a quiet voice, this is our Führer. More actually than any declamations and outbursts, Herzl concluded, it was this phrase that proved to me how deeply anti-Semitism is entrenched in the hearts of these people. End quote. At this moment, as the Jews that had been in Europe for so many centuries were again targeted as an other, Herzl felt a surge of brotherly feeling and responsibility for his people. It is this experience, as Rick Richman notes in his article on Herzl, that drove Herzl to compose The Jewish State. And it is toward the beginning of that pamphlet that Herzl stated the central sentence of his work. We are a people, one people. So he wrote, it is connection to the Jewish people, a deep sense of fellowship with other Jews and responsibility for them, that drives Jewish leadership. Moses in Egypt begins his path toward becoming the greatest Jew in history by embracing his belonging in the people of Israel. But perhaps initially, only for a moment. The next day, Hebrew slaves make clear that they do not appreciate his heroism. And, it appears, it is further because of these Hebrews that Moses' treason against Pharaoh is found out. Moses flees to the desert, marries a Midianite, and lives for many decades as a shepherd. Suddenly, as an octogenarian, he encounters God, who speaks from within a burning bush. The Almighty informs Moses that he would be the one that would lead Israel out of Egypt. Moses, in turn, haltingly replies, "Mi ani, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh?" As Rabbi Sacks comments, the statement is not only about humility, but also about identity. Moses is unsure at this moment who he truly is. Or as Rabbi Sacks writes, quote, "When Moses asks, 'Who am I?' it is not just that he feels himself unworthy. He feels himself uninvolved. He may have been Jewish by birth, but he had not suffered the fate of his people. He had not grown up as a Jew. He had not lived among Jews. He had good reason to doubt that the Israelites would even recognize him as one of them. How then could he become their leader?" End quote. But of course, Moses would emerge as Israel's leader and become the greatest Israelite of all time. And as Rabbi Sacks further reflected, it is Moses' emergence from assimilation to Israelite identity that Freud himself could not understand. Thus it was that as World War II descended, Freud published Moses and Monotheism, wherein he noted how seemingly similar Moses' origin story might appear to those ascribed to other heroes such as Romulus and Sargon. These stories feature children in terrible danger, a wondrous salvation, the separation of a child from his parents, and the eventual embrace by the child of his original identity. But the very formulaic nature of the usual tale highlights, as Freud notes, the uniqueness of Moses' origin, of Moses' tale. Rabbi Sacks summarizes, quote, "At this point, however, Freud notes that in one respect the story of Moses isn't like the others at all. In fact, it's the opposite. In the conventional story, the hero's adoptive parents are humble, ordinary people. Eventually, he discovers that he is actually of royal blood. In the Moses story," Rabbi Sacks further adds, "the reverse is the case. It is his adoptive family that is royal. His true identity," he discovers, Rabbi Sacks further writes, "is that he belongs by birth to a nation of slaves." End quote. Thus, the Moses story is the exact opposite of the classic ancient hero story. Moses, in stark contrast to mythical heroes, is adopted by royalty and embraces his belonging to a nation of slaves. Freud was so struck by this difference that he insisted that in fact Moses was actually Egyptian and had led Egypt from bondage, only to be murdered by the Israelites he led. Judaism, according to Freud, was a result of the guilt Israel felt after this event. Of course, Freud's thesis is perverse, made all the more repugnant by the fact that it was published as Jews were suffering so terribly around the world. But, as Rabbi Sacks further notes, there is also a larger lesson that the father of psychoanalysis missed. Quote, "What Freud failed to realize is that the story of Moses is not a myth, but an anti-myth. It takes a myth and turns it upside down. True royalty, the Bible suggests, is the opposite of our conventional wisdom. It isn't privilege and wealth, splendor and palaces. It's moral courage. Moses, in discovering that he is the child of slaves, finds greatness. Had Moses been an Egyptian prince, he would have been eminently forgettable. Only by being true to his people and to God did he become a hero." End quote. This is eloquent and insightful, but I would add that there is a deeper irony here that Rabbi Sacks does not note, but which, given our own subject, is worth pointing out. Freud doubted that an Israelite would grow up a member of the elite and then decide to identify with the enslaved, the poor, and downtrodden. But that, of course, is exactly what happened to Freud's neighbor, who lived several minutes away. Herzl grew up as part of European society and then decided to devote his life to his persecuted brethren. Herzl, of course, was not Moshe. No one is, but he did make the journey from assimilation to embracing his bond with the persecuted members of his people. The fact that such an unlikely event occurred, that this Freudian reversal happened, is a hint to us of the truth that the Torah sought to teach to us from the beginning of Moses' story, that the tale of the Jewish people is often a reversal of expectations, a miracle that reason cannot explain. Freud did not understand this and had dismissed Herzl's dream of a Jewish state in the Holy Land as a false hope. In a fascinating discussion on the blog of Israel's National Library, Ro Oranim describes how in 1930, following the Arab riots in the Holy Land in 1929, the head of Keren Hayesod in Vienna asked the city's most famous Jew to publicly endorse their Aliyah campaign. Freud replied, quote, "I cannot do as you wish. Whoever wants to influence the masses must give them something rousing and inflammatory. And my sober judgment of Zionism does not permit this." And he added, "It would have seemed more sensible to me to establish a Jewish homeland on a less historically burdened land." End quote. Freud thought that Herzl's dream could not become reality, but become reality it did, and we must seek to understand why. Herzl himself had originally sought, in Jewish statehood, the normalization of the Jews, which he thought would end anti-Semitism. But when Moses asks how someone like himself could lead Israel from bondage, the Almighty answers from the midst of the bush that burned atop Sinai, "For I will be with you, and this will be the sign that I have sent you. When you have taken the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." It is the providential mission of the Jews, in other words, that is reflected in its unlikely endurance and its miraculous story. And this mission lies at the heart of the bond between us all. Herzl himself seemed to grow more aware of this as his own mission continued. In an interesting series of lectures on Freud's Moses and monotheism, the distinguished historian Chaim Yosef Yerushalmi noted that in 1934, around the time that Freud began to work on this book, an article had been published attacking Freud by Carl Jung. Jung had been arguing that each nation had a collective subconscious and that Freud, quote, did not understand the Germanic psyche, end quote. Yerushalmi seems to suggest that this may have inspired Freud's own journey to examine what he saw as the Jewish subconsciousness. That journey, perhaps, brought us the awful thesis of Freud's Moses and monotheism. In truth, however, Jews do tend to speak of an inner aspect that connects us all. It is not psychological or neurological, but a metaphysical bond with one another. It lives not in the form of Freudian repressed guilt, but as something positive, which can make itself known when it is least expected. In the end, that is why Herzl's vision succeeded, because he himself suddenly found within him this, leading him to inspire so many among downtrodden Jewry. As much as we might wish it otherwise, the story of the Jews of Vienna is very relevant today. Rabbi Sacks, in a lecture on anti-Semitism, described the state of Europe as he saw it. Rabbi Sacks said, quote, "We are not today back in the 1930s, but we are coming close to 1879, when Wilhelm Marr founded the League of Anti-Semites in Germany, to 1886, when Edouard Drumont published La France Juive, and 1897, when Karl Luger became mayor of Vienna. These were key moments in the spread of anti-Semitism," Rabbi Sacks reflected, "and all we have to do today is to remember that what was said then about Jews is being said today about the Jewish state," end quote. Meanwhile, in our current moment, there are Jews that, encountering the surge of anti-Semitism, are asking themselves the age-old question first uttered by Moshe, "Who am I?" And some are suddenly cognizing their connection to their people. The metaphysical bond joining us as Jews and the strength and resiliency of our people can be felt right now. And as we begin to study the Exodus story, we realize how utterly wondrous our tale is, and we hope that the miraculous nature of Jewish history will make itself manifest again very soon. This is Meir Soloveitchik wishing you a Shabbat Shalom. Looking forward to learning together next week. Signing off.